Hey everyone, it's July 22nd, 2018, and this is your episode 158 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me as usual are Megan Arnes.
Hello.
Megan, your Ghana interview sounded excellent.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited for everyone to hear them.
I was so impressed that was just your iPhone.
Yeah, the iPhone, you know, the camera and the audio recorder. Not bad.
And Ben Charles is here, lucky to be not in the hospital at the moment. How's it going?
Yeah, man? I'm doing well. I survived a tumble on my bike going about 30 miles an hour, so feeling good on the codeine.
Have you ever considered selling codeine to any of your students or anything?
I have not, but when I got prescribed this stuff, I was like, this stuff probably has pretty good street value.
Oh, gosh.
Glad you're okay. It looks pretty gnarly.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely just a surface wound. Didn't get any broken bones or anything, luckily.
No ambulance or anything.
Nope.
Yeah, what did totally you do fine. After you fell? Did you just...
So I was out biking with a friend, and I was killing it. I was way ahead of him. I was feeling great. So then he showed up, and so he just went home, got his car, and came and picked me up. Oh. And I came home and cleaned up, and then we went to like an urgent care place, and they checked me out and got me cleaned up.
Oh, okay. Dang. Good. So you went somewhere. Yeah, I was going to say, it looks like you certainly could have gone to the hospital. But
yeah, it does.
Yeah, we'll just say you're a total freaking badass. We'll just leave it at that.
Works for me.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's cool. Well, you guys, our guest today just got back recently winning first prize at the 2018 Great Plains International Marimba Competition. Woo! He's an active educator in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and has studied with our friends and teachers, Mark Ford. Well, these are all Ben's teachers, but Mark Ford, Christopher Dean, Ed Smith, Shi-Yi Wu, and Tom Burrett. We've had all those people on the show except for Christopher Dean, so pretty exciting for us. He also has a great interest in world music, steel pan, and also tabla. And I saw on his Facebook, he's just recently, last December, started a job at Lone Star Percussion, so I want to ask him about that. So congratulations and welcome to Robert Chapman. How's it going?
Thanks for having me, guys. And if I could add, I always like to add, like, for some people, I just get this, like, first impression when I first meet or see them play or something like that. And I don't think Robert knows about this, actually, but when I was a student at UNT is when they started this Summer Marimba Academy at UNT. And I think Robert was at the first one as a high school student. And when I was in high school, I thought I was good at marimba because I was like the only person around that could hold four mallets. Robert in high school played Northern Lights at this thing.
In high school.
In high school, yeah. And like, I just remember like, and not just like hacked through Northern Lights, like satisfied Shi-Yi Wu with the performance of Northern Lights in high school. So yeah, I think from a very young age, Robert has been quite the outstanding performer. And that's certainly continued as he's matured as a musician. So Robert, I don't know if you knew that I was there, but that was something else.
Thanks, man. No, I didn't know you were there. It's cool.
Well, so, you know, this competition is sort of the headline of why we had you on. What mm-hmm. can you just tell us a little about it? And
yeah, sure. So it's, you know, it's like a 3 or 4 day event of just nonstop marimba playing. They have a bunch of high schoolers and collegiate competitors. There's a duo division that they opened a few years ago, I believe, and you know, various clinics and masterclasses from the judges that they have there. It's only been around for I think about 4 or 5 years now, but Dane Romano, the organizer, has done a really incredible job of building it into like one of the biggest, you know, percussion events in the country. So yeah, really good time, a lot of really great marimba music being heard all around, so it was a lot of fun.
What rep did you all play? Or did you play, I guess?
I played the variations on Japanese children's songs by Keiko Abe, Velocities, Joseph Schwantner, the D minor Gigue from the Bach cello suites, and then the compulsory piece was this piece called Slowly Agitated by David Reeves. I think he wrote it a few years ago, but submitted it this year, and it won the composition portion of the contest. So
yeah, great. Cool. And Pius Chang was one of your judges, right?
Yeah, he was, and he gave a couple master classes that were phenomenal.
They were really bad, I bet.
Yeah, just horrible. Played a lot of wrong notes. That's what really I thought. Bad touch on the instrument. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really bad sound.
Robert, could you tell us about both your preparation for the competition and then your sort of individual experience at the competition?
Yeah, sure. So the preparation was, you know, I started back in January because I knew this was, I competed last year. I knew this was something I wanted to do again this year. So I started the process a little bit earlier this year. First thing I did with Velocities was I knew I couldn't trust my tempo on it, so I made a custom click track for that piece to kind of keep me grounded and centered and that stuff. And that was just a lot of like small sections at a time, just really, really working the accuracy and the musicality in slow segments. And then children's songs, a lot of kind of similar segmented work. You know, the Japanese music is something I don't have as much experience in. So it was definitely an interesting experience kind of, you know, learning how that music works and how to interpret it versus Western music. So that was definitely a big learning curve for me, but did a lot of listening, read a lot of dissertations, you know, just trying to get that style in my head, basically.
Hey, could you sort of walk us through what your experience was there in terms of like, you know, waking up that morning and having to warm up and go play, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. Well, at that competition, there's a lot of downtime as there's other competitors are performing. I tried not to watch anybody in the collegiate round just because it would psych me out. And I, you know, because I would feel like the other people are playing better than me. Don't want to have that in my head as I'm going up there. But yeah, so basically there's like a master class or two in the morning, and then people compete all day, and then a master class or performance at night. So yeah, it was a lot of just kind of sitting around, and then like an hour or two of watching really great mermaid music, and then more just like waiting and warming up and stuff like that. So got to try some great food in Oklahoma City. There's a lot of places in that area, so got to do that a few times, which was nice.
Well, there is one Facebook question related to the competition, and it's sure. from William Brown. And he says, hey, Robert, so I know you competed last year as well. How has the competition changed from last year to this year?
In my personal experience, it felt really similar. Obviously, different judges means different master classes and different clinics. But like I said, I think Dane has done a really, really fantastic job of organizing this whole thing and making it as streamlined as possible. So yeah, I had a pretty similar experience between the 2 years, which was nice because going into it the second year, I kind of knew what to expect and, you know, how to prepare myself better for it this year. So
we talk a lot about, or we have on the show talked about competitions several times. We've had different mm-hmm. competition winners on, and of course we've judged competitions before. I judged with Megan a few PASICs ago, and cool. yeah, it seems like a lot of thoughts and opinions like, are competitions good? Should we do them? All that sort of thing, you know? Is right. it too competitive or whatever? What are your thoughts as far as, are you going to keep doing competitions? Have you done a lot in the past? Are you going to do some different ones?
Yeah, I've done a few in the past. I did the PASIC marimba solo competition a couple years ago. You know, various concerto competitions at UNT, other PASIC keyboard competitions. I think for me, it's just a good reason to force myself to actually practice music. And especially, you know, as I start exploring more of the world stuff and I start getting into some of the different avenues of progression, it's a good way to keep me centered on marimba and, you know, just force myself to practice. If I know I have a really important performance coming up in 5 months, I'm going to practice it more than I might otherwise. So right. yeah, I'll see. Might be a few in the future. I'm mostly just kind of preparing for grad school right now, and that's taking up a lot of my time. So, but we'll see what the future holds. I don't know.
Yeah, you gonna go to University of Missouri?
I don't know if that's on my list right now, but I can have a look at it. For sure.
Casey. I hear the teacher there is just rad.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. I'm trying to keep my options as open as possible. So,
sorry, I'm not trying to be a jerk. That's where I'm getting teachers. Sorry. Cool.
Awkward.
Hey, so I saw on Facebook you're a copyrightist at uh-huh. Lone Star. What does that mean? What does Lone Star have to worry about with copyright?
Oh, so well, a copywriter is basically just somebody who writes like product descriptions or basically little blurbs about products that websites try to sell. So basically, with Lone Star, I just write product descriptions for their website and basically just summarize like, hey, here's this product, here's the things about it, here's why you should buy it, all that good stuff. So I've been doing that for about 6 months. I only work part-time, but it's a lot of fun. I get to, you know, try out a lot of new products, which is awesome. Like always kind of having my finger on the pulse of what's coming out and different stuff. So
yeah, do you try the instruments, the new sticks, all in the shop?
It kind of depends. I work from home some, and some of it's like, you know, I've used a lot of products before, so I kind of have a sense of what buyers might be looking for. But then sometimes I'll be in the shop trying out the products as well. So,
cool. Yeah. Do you review music as well?
Yeah, I do. Occasionally I'll do sheet music and method books and stuff like that.
I'm just wondering if Casey's about to try and push his own music or Bash Pius's music again.
I was gonna go with Bash Pius's, but I guess I've already done that. No, it's good. I love the Lone Star guys. We have such a good relationship with the Lone Star folks. You know, they of course carry our music and all that.
It's cool being like when I was a student at UNT being near Lone Star, because if you ever have that sort of like, oh, I know I like the such and such marimba mallets, but I'm not sure which hardness to get or something like that. Like, you can actually go in and they'll let you into the back, like in the warehouse, and you can try out cymbals or different sticks or whatever. It's kind of cool when you're near a Lone Star, Steve Weiss.
Yeah.
You can actually check these things out in person that I think most people, most places in the country can't really do.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great resource for people in the DFW area, for sure.
Yeah, I haven't really thought of that before, but like, if you had that and then didn't have that, that would be really hard. And now I'm bummed that I thought of it because, you know, because I mean, it's like really the only time that we have to try, or like my students, for example, have is to try it out at PASIC in a loud exhibition hall, you know.
Yeah.
Or I mean, you know, companies will send you things so you can try them out. We've got a great deal like that for Interlock, and they send a lot of Black Swamp stuff here, snare drums, lots of accessories, so that students can try them out, and people buy a lot of stuff after using them for a little while. You know, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, that's super cool.
Also, like, I don't know if they would do this just anywhere, but at UNT, when I was there, I think Zildjian did this and Sabian did this, maybe Bosphorus did this. They'll have like Zildjian Day where, and they did this when I was in Miami also, like Keith Alejo will come with like a billion cymbals, drum set cymbals or orchestral cymbals, whatever, and you can try them out. And Zildjian will do a little lecture. Keith can do like a master class. And yeah, I mean, especially something like crash cymbals, you're not going to just call up Steve Weiss and order a pair for your personal use, at least. You want to try those out and get them in person. So, yeah.
We had Keith do that here at JMU. And some of the older students weren't too excited about it because they thought it was just going to be a big advertisement. You know, and we have tons of Zildjian cymbals here. We've been at Zildjian school since long before I've been here. And yeah, I mean, there's just cymbals, Zildjian cymbals everywhere. It's great. But yeah, he came and they just absolutely loved it. And he wasn't an advertisement at all.
Yeah.
Students even asked, like, so how much is this pair of cymbals? And Keith, I remember he's like, oh, I don't know. It's like probably something around. I don't know. You'd have to look it up. But anyway, check out this sound. You know, he was like, it was all about.
He's so passionate about.
Yeah, it turned into such a great day because I've got my freshman class at 11 and the cymbals had all arrived the day or so before. So we had to unbox them. So they were really stoked to just unbox them, and they all needed to have straps attached. So we all sat around and attached straps to them all. And then Keith's class started an hour later. And yeah, I mean, it was just a great class. Well, I guess we'll jump into, I have a little What's the Sound for you guys. It's kind of a quick one, and you're going to think I'm trying to trick you, but it's actually pretty simple. So don't overthink this one too much. Could actually probably cover this without hearing any of this at all, but I thought this would be a good way to make some sound out of it. So what is this?
A heartbeat.
Sounds like a heartbeat to me. Yeah,
good.
Sounds
yes,
like an ultrasound.
See, you guys are thinking like overthinking it. Yeah, that's right. It's a heartbeat. Way simple. Yeah. So it's the sound of heartbeat and blood flow. And the reason I bring that up is because that's something you may hear in your own body if you're in what's called an anechoic chamber. Have you guys ever heard of anechoic chambers before?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, so anechoic meaning not echoing chamber. It's basically the soundproof room where they actually measure the sound in negative decibels, so like below what we can audibly hear. And of course, if you've ever been in a sound studio, you've seen soundproofing, you can imagine the whole wall-to-wall, ceiling, and underneath your feet just has very specific and detailed soundproofing, you know, those wedges, those triangles that block out all sorts of sound. And they say reported in 2012, the longest anyone can stand in an anechoic chamber was 45 minutes because it is just so disorienting to be in one of those chambers. And when you get in one, they insist that you sit down because people have really bad reactions to being in them because it just really messes with your senses. One report said, when it's quiet, your ears will adapt. The quieter the room, the more things you hear. You'll hear your own heart beating. Sometimes you can hear your lungs. In an anechoic chamber, you become sound. The experience is so disorienting that most chamber facilities require the user to sit down. A study published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease published that it only takes 15 minutes of sensory deprivation, which can cause hallucinations. The sound in these rooms is measured in negative decibels. Sorry, I said that already, but reported as low as -negative dB. Human ears here at zero. So they use these for a lot of interesting research and things that you would think go way beyond just having minus sound. But I thought of this actually last week when we had Lynn Vartan on, and I was looking for something that's happening in Utah, and one of her neighboring schools there in Utah, Brigham Young University, has a pretty famous anechoic chamber. So
you came across it on their website, or like how?
Oh, I don't remember how the heck I bumped into it. You know, so I've got a Google Doc just of like sound ideas, and I threw it on there.
I see.
A long time ago, I probably bumped into it online or something.
I see.
Yeah. So that's your sound for the day.
That's
pretty short.
Crazy. So yeah. Wait, can you say again of what kind of research it's used for?
So one was that I read something about jet engines, like they,
what?
And these rooms are not that big. You could never fit anything that big in there, but for some, and it's on the Brigham Young University website. If you want to go check it out and read the details, I thought, oh, this is going to get way over my head way too fast. So I'll just share like kind of the basics of it.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, something about the efficiency of it and the sound the engine is making and the harmonics. And a simpler one would be, say, they use it for like Bose noise canceling research or something, right?
Those
headphones that work on noise canceling. So it's real important. If you're going to test that stuff, you got to have like an absolutely silent environment, which is really something that we've probably never experienced. You know, even when you say, oh, I experienced silence for the first time, it's like, yeah, but you probably didn't actually. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool.
There's like I watched a while back, I want to say a pretty good length YouTube video on like one of these, and the guy like went in with his like sound recorder and like had the experience. I think it might've been the one of Brigham Young, but yeah, there's definitely some footage on YouTube if you're interested.
I think it is, Ben. Yeah. He has his recorder in his hand and they have the door open. And he does something like he's snapping his fingers, just making a simple sound. And as they shut the door, they show the waveform of his clicking, and it just shrinks down from like a little bit of echo to none. So you can just kind of watch it progressively as they shut the door go from what's already really dry, but it goes from dry to super, super dry.
Wow. That's crazy. I wonder what that would feel like.
Yeah.
Only
yeah,
they had those at ASIC to test out your triangles.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. I wonder if there's something like that. I mean, I'm sure it's incredibly expensive to create these things, but like in a science center or something, I wonder if there's any kind of place where you can go to experience it, you know?
I think there are several of them. And really, it's sure it's expensive, but probably as far as, you know, settings for experiments, it's probably one of the cheaper ones that are out there, because it's really just the sound wedges. You just have to head to toe cover it, and you have to create a floor that you can stand on, and then below that you have also the sound blocking material. So really it's just a room, all the sound blocking material, and something special to set up with the floor.
Mm-hmm. So are you gonna make one?
I am not gonna make one. I want more sound, not less. Yeah. I want my instruments louder, not quieter. Yeah. Ben, you got a Facebook question there.
Yeah, we've got several Facebook questions to choose from, but I will go ahead and ask this one from Matt Kosick, because part of the way that I know Robert is he teaches at my friend Frankie Burke's school. So shout out to Frankie Burke. And the question is, how do you balance your public teaching gigs with trying to be a professional performer slash voice in the percussion community?
Oh, awesome. Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of it, honestly, is just like, especially in terms of time management, is just trying to compartmentalize my life as much as possible. So like when I'm teaching, I'm trying to make sure that I'm not thinking about, you know, what I'm going to be practicing later on or the other life stuff that I have to take care of. Like I have to make sure that I'm completely in the teaching zone with that. And then when I do get home and there's time to practice, I have to make sure that I'm 100% in that when I'm in that moment. And if I take time off and play video games or just browse the internet or whatever, I have to make sure I'm not thinking about those other things, you know, just to kind of separate my life as much as possible and keep it compartmentalized. I had a really bad burnout a couple of years ago that almost made me quit playing music altogether. And it was just because I was trying to do everything at once. So I know for me, like that compartmentalization is super important and super helpful. You need time to like decompress everything throughout the week. So
you said video games. We should elaborate.
Yeah. As in like what kind? What about?
Yeah, we should definitely take many, many minutes talking about this.
No, sure. I said me. It's my turn. So,
oh, you're right.
Robert, how did you get through that burnout? We talk about avoiding burnout a lot on the podcast, mm-hmm. but it's pretty rare that someone says, you know, maybe not rare, but that says that, you know, I experienced burnout. I actually got there or I got very close. How did you get out of it? I'm curious.
And was that in school or out of school that you experienced this?
Kind of a little bit of both. I was in school when it happened, and I actually dropped out for a couple of years to try to like figure out my life and get everything put back together. And then I went back to reapplied and got back into school after that.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, Megan. What was your question one more time?
How did you get out of burnout?
Oh, yeah. So it was mostly just I just kind of stopped music altogether, was trying to figure out other things in my life that I could do or wanted to do, you know, and didn't really come up with anything. So I think taking some time off really, really helped. And then again, just like, you know, figuring out how to manage my time best and compartmentalize my time. That was a really big deal.
Yeah. So you feel like if that were to happen again, or, you know, you start to feel signs of that, because you
Absolutely.
Got so close, you know what to do now, sort of.
Yeah, I know all the signs of that happening. So it's a little bit easier to kind of manage it now, mm-hmm. for sure. But yeah, definitely taking some time off and kind of rediscovering why I love music or why I started to get into it in the first place. That was extremely helpful, for sure.
Yeah.
Because what you said is one thing I hear a lot is like, remember why you started doing this in the first place. I think it's easy to lose sight of that.
Absolutely. Especially in music school when it's just nonstop all the time and you're being judged and graded for different, you know, performances. You know, it can be pretty brutal. I would
love to have a definition of burnout. I know we've talked about this before, but do we all agree it means you practice so hard that you don't want to practice anymore?
Yeah, I would agree.
Exactly,
with that.
Right.
Yeah,
it can be, but I think it can also just like just a loss of desire. Like, I don't think it's necessarily over practicing. I have students that get burned out from not practicing,
or even like frustration or loss of interest in. I've felt symptoms of this for sure before, where I start to this is a longer story that I will not share right now, but you know, I start to kind of like hate a particular kind of music, and the sound almost makes me like kind of sick or something, or like I don't want to hear it. And that's happened to me in like several different genres before, and even with sound, like particular types of sound. So maybe that could be another type of burnout.
Yeah, I definitely relate to. I remember the first sign for me was I woke up one morning and I had to go to a wind band rehearsal, and it like almost made me like physically ill.
Yeah.
To think about going to, you know, and doing that again. So.
Huh.
Yeah, I totally relate.
Interesting.
I know. Just. Interesting story, like in the Rebecca Kite Keiko Abe biography, I can't remember what the reason was, but for some reason, I don't know if she gave up on music or what, but Keiko Abe actually stopped playing music for a while, and she said that taking the time away from music was the thing that made her realize how valuable it was to her when she came back. So I think that it is often important to get away from it for a little bit and do something else and realize how much it meant to you and come back to it. And I think it can give you a new perspective.
Yeah. I think
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was going to just say, like, what Robert did, which is taking time off, is one of the most valuable things. My brother did that in college, not from music, but from his field. And I think I've seen students that are completely burned out, just don't want to do it anymore, but they just sort of continue to force the, you know, square peg into the round hole just because they're like, well, I'm here already. It's like, well, no, go take time off and come back. It'll be better, I promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or even exploring something at the same time. Like, I had a really great experience with a student over the past, I guess, about 3 years who, you know, she was approaching burnout and we had conversations about it. And, you know, we're in such an amazing position being private teachers where we can check in with people week to week. And I think it's so important to be constantly but checking in and talking about these things. And it was a great experience because I just encourage the student to go explore other things. And she's so talented. And it was really hard for me to say, like, well, go take this class or go do that. And in the back of my mind, I was like, is she going to like it? I want to ask her. And I like gave it time. And eventually, you know, we had another conversation about it. And she kind of came full circle and was like, you know, no, that's not quite right. And she fell back in love with music, basically, and kind of found another outlet. She basically ended up deciding to do music therapy, but finished her performance degree and like with flying colors. And it was so cool because she was unable to hide her burnout. She was completely unable. And so, you know, when I saw it starting to happen, I was so worried about her. And then once she got over it, I could see it immediately. And I was so happy that she went through that. You know, she went through that whole process because it's not easy to do it. But I think if you push it away, it's going to come back. So like you said, exploring other things or seeing if there are other avenues that you might want to pursue. And then when you have those thoughts again, it's like, oh, well, I already explored that. I don't want to do that. So yeah, right, life is not always like rainbows and puppies, and that's okay.
For sure.
I think it's tough if you have a student that's working really hard and they get burnout. Then you have the incorrect kind. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced the incorrect kind. Like, wait, you're practicing 3 hours a week and you're getting burnt out on practicing? Like,
yeah.
That one is harder for me to tackle.
That's like loss of interest. That's not.
Yeah.
I would say that's, yeah, maybe they've got the definition of burnt out wrong there. I don't know.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I think so. That's why I thought it was good to clarify what it even is, you know.
Well,
or like, were they practicing 4 hours or 5 hours a day before that and then it went down, or have they always been, you know? I think that's also important.
Yeah, and and I'm speaking pretty hypothetically here. I think it's one thing of, okay, you're not motivated or you're just disinterested, but yeah, they'll call it burnout.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I guess it's fine, but like the solution there is definitely not, oh, you probably need to go on a vacation and explore the mountains and go on a hike for a few months. Yeah, like, no, that's not. You have a more serious problem.
Yeah, right.
Well, I have a sort of, I guess, follow-up question to the burnout topic for Robert. I mean, there was some day in particular where you decided, yes, I'm going to drop out of school. I mean, you thought about it for a while, I'm sure, but that was a very immediate decision.
Yeah.
It was a binary thing, I could say. When you were getting back into it, did you feel the same sort of one day you just woke up and you said, like, okay, let's do this, I'm back in? Or was it like a gradual process?
I think it was more gradual. It was always kind of in the back of my head to go back. Because I, you know, I'd already spent so much time in school and I was close enough to finishing. Like, the thought was, I have like a year and a half of credits left. Why spend all this money and not just finish it out? So I have something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I took some time off and just taught. And I think through teaching private lessons and working with front ensembles, I kind of, you know, rediscovered my love for music. And it was kind of a gradual process to get back into it. But that really, really helped, you know, just teaching and helping other people, I guess, discover what they like about music. kind of helped me figure that out as well.
So basically, meeting Frankie Burke was what did it for you.
Essentially, yeah, it was all Frankie's doing.
It seems like it's something that's come along with, we can get information so fast. It's very easy to see how much you're not doing. You know, I know right. I feel this. Yeah, we all probably feel this. You can just take a 3-minute stroll around Facebook and see what other musicians are doing and immediately feel like, wow, there's kind of no ceiling here. I could really keep practicing and learning something new. And as soon as I'm done with this, well, there's so many other things I could be doing. And I imagine before all that, people were maybe healthier in this regard, or at least maybe more people were, I don't know.
Yeah. I know for me, that was part of it as well. It was just assuming that everybody was just going nonstop and practicing 8 hours a day and, you know, still super into music. When I did burn out and I didn't want to do it anymore, I felt very isolated in that. But, you know, kind of coming to the realization that everybody goes through this point at some part was very, you know, kind of put my mind at ease with that.
So, gotcha.
Well, on that note, speaking of all this other stuff you can do in music and how you can sort of never run out of things to practice as a percussionist, we have another Facebook question from Shane Jones talking about your interest in world music. And he says, how does your tabla and steel pan playing inform your marimba playing and vice versa? And I'm assuming that you studied not tabla, but Indian music with Puvalar Sriji as well.
Yeah. So just a little introduction into my experience with that stuff. I studied with Professor Sriji for about 3 years. I was in his ensemble, and through that time, you know, took different Carnatic theory lessons with him, and played a little bit of Kanjira with him, but nothing too serious. And after that, discovered another teacher at UNT who plays tabla and teaches, so decided to sit down with him as well. So the tabla is relatively...
Who is that?
His name is Dr. Vivek Virani.
Okay.
He just started as an ethnomusicology professor at UNC. So,
cool.
But phenomenal tabla player, studied in India for a few years. And so, it's an interesting question. I don't know if there are like specific things I can point out that like, this tabla thing or this steel pan thing translates to my marimba playing this way, but I know playing steel pan taught me a lot about groove and touch and feel. It's really easy. You have to have a super light touch when you're playing pan, otherwise they get to what we call barking super easily. So having that like relaxed approach on that instrument and, you know, being very, very aware of my touch and my sound translated really easily to marimba. And with the, you know, studying the Indian music, they look at rhythm in such a completely different way than Western musicians do. It really helped solidify my time and my sense of rhythm. And, you know, there's just so many theoretical things that are different as well. They have this format in tabla playing called Kaida and Palta, which is basically there's a set composition, and then you just go through just an infinite number of variations on that set composition, basically all improvised. And I've tried to take some of those approaches into my marimba playing and my snare drumming and all that stuff as well, just to kind of really explore all the different options with different ideas. So,
yeah, I will say not to answer the question for Robert, but having also studied Indian music with Sriji at UNT, it's interesting how much more complex the rhythms in Indian music are. And seeing something like Alejandro Vignal now, like rhythmically, I mean, it's still difficult, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't faze me at all having gone through these sort of, you know, 17, 16 meters and stuff like that with Sriji. Just the rhythmic complexity in Indian music makes anything in Western music look like child's play, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it also forces you to like reconceptualize how you think about rhythm as well.
Yeah, it's not so much like subdivided into beats.
Right. Yeah. It's not like vertical. It's based on what came before and after it. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So you guys are burning me out already. Like,
sorry.
This is so hard. This is like tabla playing is another thing I can't do. Like,
me
I'm
too.
Don't right, look at it that to, way. Don't look at it that way.
All right, no, Megan, I'm gonna try to get good at that too. I'm burnt out. I can't.
No,
I can't.
Don't look at it that way. Can we do?
How do you
can
look
we do
at
my
it?
Segment?
Casey, you just need to abandon your
segment.
You just need to abandon Laurel and the baby. Just go to Ghana, study for like a month.
So I'm joking around, of course. But this is, I think, how people really feel. You know, it's sort of like you go to you go to PASIC, you see all this other stuff, and you go like, oh man, I got to get good at all this other stuff. And then people get students get really get frustrated and they get overwhelmed. But how should we look at it, Megan?
Here's what I think. I think that, you know, by looking at all of these other things, rather than looking at them and being like, oh my gosh, there's all these things that I have to master, getting really stressed out about it, I think we look at them and we realize the depth of our field and our instrument genre, and we should just look at that and be amazed by it, because it's amazing and we can never master it all. And I think, you know, going to a place like Ghana or India and studying these traditions, at least what I have experienced, every time I've started learning the music of another culture, I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to do this all the time. I want to get so good at this. And like, whoa, I'm picking this up and this is great. Oh my gosh. And then you get more and more and you're like, I will never be able to master this. And it's not even like, because you realize the depth of it, it's not even just like, okay, I learned all the songs. It's, or, you know, even if you were able to get through a vast amount of repertoire, you will never be, all four of us will never be Indian. All four of us will never be Ghanaian. I don't think, unless you guys are Indian and you're not telling me, I don't know. But, you know, there is so much of the culture and growing up in the culture and experiencing the culture and living it that influences the playing, that even if you are a master musician in a culture that you do not belong to or that you didn't grow up in, still something is missing, you know? So I don't know. I think I came to this, I don't know when I came to this realization, but when I came to that realization, I was a lot happier. And I feel like I was sold as a musician so much more, sold on being a musician so much more, because I was like, oh my gosh, I can use the rest of my life to like try to travel to these places and like experience just the tip of the iceberg for all of these things. No matter how much I study, it still feels like the tip of the iceberg, because you realize it's deeper and deeper and deeper. Does that make sense?
So, of course, you're totally right, and I think we all agree with you. And it's easy for us to look at it that way because we've embraced that student for life mentality thing that is the saying and people talk about all the time. And we're so, and I agree, like that makes me happy too. It's like, yes, this never ends. It's great. Students who still haven't found themselves, they still haven't found what they are, they still haven't established that feeling of self-worth as a musician, I think they're much more susceptible to this being a challenge, because they see all these things and they go like, oh wow, I just went to PASIC and I learned about 100 other things I'm not good at, and I'm still trying to get good at this one thing, and it's like so overwhelming. And I think other than telling them what you told them, they're like, no, this is an opportunity, this is exciting, this is telling you that you get to learn this stuff your whole life and it never ends, and that's great. And they go, oh my God, it never ends. That's terrible. That's not good, you know?
I wonder if it's totally a personality thing, Casey. Like, I wonder if we took a survey of, like, if we took a survey of students in all of our percussion studios, it'd be interesting to say, like, how did you feel after returning from PASIC? Did you feel overwhelmed? Did you feel inspired? Did you feel, you know? And, like, what would we get? We'd probably get a complete mix of responses.
I think we get a mix, but if I go from my own personal experience, I went to PASIC. My first ever was 2000, so I was a freshman in college, and I went with a bunch from the studio. Most everyone in the studio felt overwhelmed, and PASIC almost made them depressed, whereas I was really excited. I got really, really excited. But I also think I had a lot more practicing and time under my belt, and I had a lot more sense of, okay, I know what I got to get good at, but I also already feel like I'm good at something.
What do you guys think, Ben and Robert? Or what did you think when you went to PASIC for the first time? And did it change over the years?
My first PASIC, I just went to the exhibit hall and tried out all the marimbas. I'm kind of just tuned out everything else, so I don't know if I had that.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
That's what we'll tell them to do.
Yeah.
Don't go to classes.
Don't do any of that. Just
look at gear. It's all about gear.
No, I was going to say I didn't notice that so much my first PASIC. Just as I got older, the more and more I go, like I walk through the exhibit hall and I see the, you know, 17-year-old Robert Chapman's playing Northern Lights in the exhibit hall, and I'm just like, the older I get, I feel like the more intimidated I get by people in the exhibit hall.
I'm like completely opposite of you guys, I guess. I don't know. And I feel like my students too, because they, every time we go back, we have like, you know, we have a, cause we apply for this travel grant every year. And one of the requirements is that you have to share with the rest of the organization or whatever. And everyone's always just like, oh my gosh, it's so amazing. And there's so many things. And I think they're also like excited to see, you know, people that they know from other places, which I don't know. I mean, maybe it would be different if they went in high school, but I have freshmen through grad students that go, and the freshmen don't seem to be overwhelmed.
That's cool.
I don't
know.
Good.
I feel that way too. I mean, I'm just happy to see. Yeah. I'm happy to see everything.
I will say, Megan, to your earlier point, starting with this, when I started studying Tableau for the first time, I kind of tried to go into the mindset that I'm never going to be good at this instrument, or, you know, I'll watch videos of, you know, my grand teacher, Swapan Chowdhury, and just realize that my hands are never going to do that. I'm never going to sound that good. And it's very freeing in terms of that yeah. studying, because I don't have that level of expectation for myself. It's just trying to explore and enjoy the process as much as possible. But I will say, definitely having like more of a Western background and feeling grounded in something like that definitely helps. So that when that becomes too frustrating, there's always something I can come back to. You know?
Right. Because it almost feels more like a hobby than your job.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
For sure.
Do you ever perform on tabla outside? Like I've seen like your little Instagram videos, but do you ever like have tabla gigs or anything?
I have not yet. No. I probably won't for many years. You know, just cause there, it's just a whole, incredibly deep study. I know, like, for example, I mean, Bob Becker.
As a non-tabla player, I mean, like, the sounds you get out of them sound, you know, like, I've tried it before, and it's not easy.
Thanks.
And you seem to be doing well.
What kind of mallet do you hit it with, Ben?
Casey Cangelosi mallets, the blue ones.
Oh, that's right. Good job.
I was going to say chime hammers, but that's a better answer.
Is that?
Yeah.
What were you going to say about Bob Becker, Robert?
Oh, I was going to say, I read somewhere that Bob Becker, you know, who's, like, considered one of the great tabla players of, like, from the Western side of things. I read somewhere guy. That yeah, yeah for exactly I read somewhere that he didn't play publicly for 12 years after beginning his tabla study, so that's a pretty good indication that it takes a minute to kind of let that music sink in.
Yeah, so for sure.
Well, speaking of Bob Becker, have you ever seen his piece called Palta?
Yeah, actually my teacher Dr. Varani performed it with the UNT percussion ensemble.
Oh, that's gotcha. Cool. Yeah,
yeah,
really, yeah, really. So it's piece. There's like, I think three versions of it kind of included. There's one for a drum set, which I've done. There's one for, you can do it on like hand drums, like congas or something like that. And then there's a tabla specific score in there as well. But yeah, it sounds like, I guess you have seen it performed. Is that something that like a Western tabla player such as yourself, could you see yourself being able to do that piece one day on tabla?
Oh yeah, for sure. And definitely having the Western background helps. So you know how to kind of like interact with that type of ensemble and do all that stuff. But a lot of that's very improvisatory. And I don't see myself being at that level for many, many years. But, you know, again, it's just a process. I'm trying to enjoy it as much as possible.
Yeah, I think that piece reminds me of hearing Svet talk about Temezcal and why am I blanking on the name? The one for Zarb, Korakor. He said that, you know, like, we get intimidated by playing this strange like Persian drum, but the guys that play that drum for real aren't going to play Korakor. So you almost have the advantage as the Westerner that's familiar with the style of music, but not familiar with the instrument. So again, Palta, I mean, I'm sure we could explain to an Indian musician the rhythmic cycles or whatever, and they could do it. But as a Westerner, we actually understand sort of the written aspect of it, maybe not so much the improvisatory aspect.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
What kind of stick do you hit Zarb with, Ben?
Casey Cangelosi mouse, the
oh,
purple
one. My student Adam DiPersio, he's been on the show a couple times. He's helped us with the group interviews. He was on the So Percussion episode. I swear he has the best Korakor I've ever seen. It's really, really something else. But cool. We should move on. Megan, you have something for us today.
Yeah, I have a little topic that's like totally can add to the conversation that we're having right now. It's a little story from the podcast NPR's Hidden Brain. And it's looking at the powerful connection between the ideas we dream up and the people who surround us and what it really takes to think outside the box. That's the mission of the podcast, Hidden Brain. So check that out. Subscribe to it. They've got some great stories on there. But I didn't know about it before I got Silk Road Ensemble's email blast a couple weeks ago. And one of these episodes was featuring one of their musicians, Christina Pato. And the post is actually from July 2nd. And the text portion of the article, I love how NPR sets these up because they give you a section that you can read, a text portion, and then they also give you the audio portion. So the text portion is set up like this. There's great comfort in the familiar. It's one reason humans often flock to other people who share the same interests, laugh at the same jokes, hold the same political views. But familiar ground may not be the best place to cultivate creativity. And the name of the podcast is The Edge Effect. And an example that is given in the very beginning of the podcast is of research papers. So the study is that research papers that were written by people with diverse backgrounds have more citations. So they're used in other studies and, you know, referred to more than papers that are written by people in the same community or with the same background or probably in the same field. This can refer to race, fields, you know, gender, I mean, anything really. So it's suggesting that you are actually at a disadvantage if you are surrounded by people of the same group, no matter what group that is. So then the social scientist Adam Galinsky kind of takes this idea and explores it in the arts, fashion, and business. He's a social scientist, so that's his research area. And the story that drew me to this article and the one that I enjoyed the most was about Christina Pato. And she plays the Galician bagpipe. So she's from Spain. And Galicia, I guess, is what it says. I want to say the C, but it's Spain, from Spain. So that C is pronounced T-H. Galician, I think, is how you pronounce it. Bagpipe. And she's now in Silk Road Ensemble, but she started traveling from Spain to the United States to study classical piano. And she actually grew up playing these bagpipes. So when she came to the United States, she kind of set them aside and just gave all her efforts to playing classical piano and really studying very hard. At one point, she was in an ensemble where she was asked to translate something, and through a series of events, she found herself talking to Oswaldo Goliov, who she didn't know who at the time, but is a famous Argentinian composer. And he was fascinated by where she was from. And I think she mentioned that she played the bagpipes, and he was like very interested in that. So he eventually invited her to come to a gathering of friends, which was basically a jam session, and it ended up being at Tanglewood. So she's like, okay, sure, I'll bring my bagpipes, I'll go, I'll check it out. She didn't know that the jam session was Silk Road Ensemble members. And she didn't even know that when she got there and she started jamming. She had the best time and she connected with all these musicians. And eventually, you know, she met Yo-Yo Ma and eventually she was eventually invited to join the group and collaborate with the group. So there's a wonderful video of her on the page where you can see her performing on NPR. And it's wonderful. She's an amazing musician. And for those of you not familiar with Silk Road Ensemble, I've talked about it in a previous segment, so you can find out some more. But it's an amazing group made up of musicians from all different backgrounds, all different countries. And I guess Yo-Yo Ma is the one that coined this term. The edge effect is when one or more kind of societies or communities come together and collaborate. So the other stories in this article were studies by Adam Galinsky, who is a professor of business at Columbia Business School. And he does research on diversity and creativity, and he's the co-author of the book Friend and Foe, which offers new ways of thinking about conflict and cooperation. So in one of his studies, his research has found that people who have people who have deep relationships with someone from another country become more creative and score higher on routine creativity tests. So he says that there's something about deeply understanding and learning about another culture that's transformative. And so one of his studies is through a business school, a 10-month MBA program. And he tested the students using standard creativity measures, both at the beginning of the term and the end of the term. And he found out that students who had dated someone from another country during the term actually became more creative. And in another study, he found that simply reflecting on one's deep relationship with a person from another country caused a temporary boost in creativity. He expands this out to fashion, and he looks at a lab of fashion designers and fashion lines. And over 21 seasons, so a long period of time, he found that fashion designers who were immersed in a different culture for a long period of time, not just visited another country, but were really living and immersed in another culture, and not necessarily in another country, just in another community or just a different culture outside of their own, he was able to predict their entire fashion line creativity level. So that's super interesting. I'd like to know more about that that story, because I'd like to actually see, you know, see what he's talking about. I think it's really interesting. But anyway, I think the thesis is fascinating, and you know, it's rooted in scientific evidence, but it also can be applied to arts and business and fashion. And I think it ties into our conversation too, where is, you know, why do we study music from other cultures? What's the point? Especially if the conclusion we're coming at to, or the conclusion that we're coming to is we cannot become masters, or, you know, masters in the sense that we cannot become someone that we're not, then why do it? And this is a great reason for why. It actually boosts our creativity. And I would take that argument further and, you know, romanticize it and say that it makes the world a better place because we're able to understand each other better. And if you look at what Silk Road is doing, it's a perfect example of they're making a new genre of music by collaborating with people from all over the world. I mean, it's amazing what they do when they combine these musicians together and these different styles together, and they experiment and jam. And it's amazing some of the project that they have come up with.
So I listened. I didn't read, but I listened. It sounds like it's the same course. And yeah, Yo-Yo Ma describes the edge effect as I guess when two ecosystems meet. So, and I think the one they say on the audio is where the desert meets the forest. So there's this, you know, there's this strip of unique space where it's both of them combined, of course, which is totally what you said. And the science, they do say it's hard to measure creativity, but they can do it through measuring divergent versus convergent thinking, which I think we've talked about on this show already. And they also say at the end of it, they say they can't be exactly sure if the people who are mixing with other cultures, if they're more creative because they're mixing with other cultures or because they are simply more open-minded. Mm-hmm. So, and in either case, I think it basically advocates the same thing. So right. You want to be good at this, you need to be open-minded, or you need to do things that will make you open-minded. So I kind of think they're one and the same. So they do say that at the very end, and it's kind of that old mystery, like, well, does Harvard make geniuses, or does Harvard just attract all the geniuses? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, and I tend to think, yeah, people who are open-minded, you're going to date people from other cultures, and thus you're like already inherently primed to be more creative. And then of course you can accept the information you get from the other cultures. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That was a cool connection, I thought.
Yeah, you're almost like, I mean, it's basically saying that open-minded, I mean, it's also tying together open-mindedness and creativity, which is awesome.
Yeah, I thought those three words, like being open-minded, being creative, and also mixing with other cultures and knowing people from other cultures. And I loved the part about dating people from other cultures. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Even dating, it's like friend dating too, just like spending time with, you know?
Yeah. The science portion they talked about, they said mixed couples had better papers, like had That's better true. Publications, had more publications, had more citations. So if like two people co-wrote a paper, and he was from there, she was from over here, or whatever, and the paper was better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was neat. What do you got, Ben?
Well, yeah, I just had two things to add. One is that I think it's no secret you see this a lot in the tech industry with companies like Google and Apple are very interested in, you know, diverse hires and diversifying their boards and their executive leadership. But then also I was just going to say that sort of circling back around to like why bother studying ethnomusicology if you're not going to become a tabla master or something like that. I think you could make, you know, almost a parallel argument to like, if you're going to be a percussion performer, why are you studying music harmony or music theory or music history? Because I'm not going to master music history as a percussion performer, but it helps inform your playing. And I think it's almost more valuable for a percussionist to study world music, which so much of our music is, what's the word I'm looking for, is touched by, I don't know, is changed
influenced by,
yeah, there's the word, by world music rather than, I don't know why I couldn't come up with that, it's the codeine talking, but yeah, it's influenced by that rather than, I mean, it's not to say anything bad about Bach or Leonin and Periton, but I can't think of really, other than just playing Bach on marimba, most marimba compositions don't invoke Gregorian chant or anything like that.
Yeah, and also like studying ethnomusicology is not about mastering the tabla or mastering any, you know, instrument right. that's outside the Western culture. It's the study of music in societies and how music exists in societies and communities. So I think people misunderstand that a lot too, the meaning. And I think by studying ethnomusicology, it does kind of inform our study of instruments outside the Western tradition in the Western tradition also.
Yeah
that's like Michael Spiro was the
exactly
textbook.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's one of those things that, you know, we've been told our whole lives when we're students, man, my music theory is hard and I just want to practice, I don't want to do music theory, but your teachers tell you like, no, it relates, it's valuable, then you don't really believe it yet, you know, you don't really. It takes some experiences for it to sink in, and years later it really sinks in, and now we know, like, no, that's like a really important ingredient to the whole musician.
Yeah, and it's hard too because, you know, our instrument specifically percussion is changing, right? It's developing and advancing and all this new repertoire and all these things, and so I think it's hard when students come to us and say, oh man, music theory, or, you know, I hate this and blah blah blah, I don't want to spend my time doing that. We're mentioning the importance of theory and history from Western music theory and Western music history, but also it can be argued that, as we just talked about for the last 20 minutes, that it's very important to study music from other cultures and to have an understanding of how music exists in societies and other places. So it's hard because our percussion is changing so much. And if that is becoming really important, it's becoming a big part of our instrument area and a part of our genre. And we need to study that too. We need to study ethnomusicology. We should have the experience of studying music from another country. So, you know, it's hard because the curriculum, our percussion field is advancing so fast and it's so exciting, but the field of music, of study of Western music is behind that, I think, in my opinion. Yeah. It's going to take a long time for it to catch up.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
You can cut all that out.
No, that was great. No, that's a rant. That's perfect. I don't know if you guys have ever been in a clinic situation. You're giving a clinic and you've got content you're really passionate about, but the audience is kind of there for something else. It's only happened to me once, and it was just my perception. Maybe it went a lot better than I thought, but I was explaining a very broad musical idea that's kind of applies everywhere, but I felt like the whole audience were just students there trying to learn how to play Porgy and Best better to learn to win a job.
Yeah.
And the response I was getting was like, okay, when are you going to move on to something that's going to help me win
a
job? Right. Well, and the feeling was is okay. Yeah, this information's great, but I don't have time for great. I got to win.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have time for information I don't absolutely need right now. And I kind of just want to say, like, dude, you don't know how this might apply to you. We don't have to justify every little thing we're learning. Sometimes information is just good because it's information. You know.
Do a class for Texas high school students. You'll that's the feeling you get on.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, it's like, so let's talk about like what is music, and it's like, okay, but I need to win my state audition, or it's like, never mind.
Man, I gotta give a prop to the Interlaken kids, because I do not feel like that at all, and it's amazing. We just had Ross Carr here yesterday. He did this awesome master class on, you know, all kinds of extended techniques and things that they will never use here. Well, actually, that's not true at all. They do need to like bow super balances, but they're not playing contemporary chamber music here, right? Yeah. And they were so into it. It was awesome. I did some world music stuff, and they're so into it, and they're not doing any of that here. So there is hope.
I think Robert could speak to the sort of Texas mentality of like, you got to make it to state. You got to get a one on your solo. And like, that didn't exist when I was in high school. And I'm not from Texas. I'm from Virginia, but like, I never experienced those things. And I think that it actually overall can raise the sort of average level of everyone, but it can also sort of destroy some individual creativity in those students that could be superstars.
Yeah, for sure. In the students' defense, they're stretched pretty thin. So I always try to give my students the benefit of the doubt when it's like...
I mean, it's so easy, I think, to bash Texas music education based on the fact that it's all about winning. But then I look around the rest of the country and it's like, yeah, well, it's way better in Texas than it is most other places. Yeah, I mean, I think the level is overall very high. It's just sometimes I wish it wasn't so about winning or getting a one or whatever.
Yeah, there are some things that kind of fall by the wayside when they're basically just like focused on the standardized testing version of
that's a good way of putting it.
Robert, do you hope to get out of Texas for grad school?
Yes, that is
where do you want to go?
It's too hot here. I have a short list. A lot of schools in the Northeast. I've been taking a little break from life and everything after Great Plains and band camps. So the second half of my summer goal is to figure out, you know, exactly where I want to go and what it's going to take to get me there. But cool. Someplace that's not in the 110s, 3 months out of the year would be great.
So. Right. Well, are you guys ready for your quiz?
Yes.
All right. Now, Robert, these are questions from old episodes. So we're over 150 now, so it's very easy to forget these things. But hopefully, Ben and Megan and I can remember some of this. So you guys, the score right now is Laurel 5. Megan's missed a few episodes. She's missed a few chances. Megan 0 and Ben with 3. So
you really have to rub it in?
Well, I just have to state the facts. So, okay, here we go. We got 3 questions today, as usual. And we begin... Okay, this Hungarian psychologist co-directs the Quality of Life Research Center and is part of the growing field of positive psychology. Laurel has reported on his book, Creativity, Flow, and the Psychology of Discovery and Invention.
Mihai Mihai. Mihai
Mihai. His first name is Mihai, I know.
You already used that one, Casey.
But I haven't done it on the show. That was the practice one. No, so you get those points, Megan. That's it.
I said it too. I got it.
I know, but Megan first. Was quick. Then in your defense, you are high as a kite on codeine right now. No, you both definitely were in there. It came through Megan as first to me. Yeah. Okay, this one will be another quickie. This one's pretty easy. At Percussion Podcast guest told us about his extensive arranging project of the works of John Sappas.
Omar Comandantes.
Omar.
It goes to Megan again.
From my perspective, I said at the same time as Megan. That's what I heard.
I was definitely before you.
I'm not making this up.
I think there's a delay on my connection.
That could be. Sometimes it's about the best tool you have. Sometimes the sharpest knife wins. So, okay. Anyway, last question. In the year 2015, Megan reported on the Et Percussion podcast episode number 8, there was a group of 1,000 musicians in Italy got together to create a cover band that consisted of 350 guitars, 250 singers, 250 drummers, and 150 basses. Ben's looking it up right now.
Hurry, go!
He's totally looking it up. They.
No, I typed the answer.
No, I'm not done. I'm not done. They. Okay, so the cover band, in an amazing performance and in unison spread across an open field, performed the song called Learn to Fly by what band?
Foo Fighters.
That was good. That was, yeah, very close. I'm sorry, Ben, it came through as Megan
Anthony. I typed the answer like 30 seconds ago because I knew what it was going to be already.
Me too. Look in the chat. I didn't type it because that's cheating.
This is the problem with the game as I initially spelled out, is like just the logistics of facilitating it. So this is tough, but this is good. It makes the scores very close.
I feel like you definitely threw me a bone there, Casey, or three bones.
I did. I definitely picked questions that would be in Megan's favor because she missed some episodes and she was at zero. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Very
yeah, you're welcome.
You.
You're welcome. So that's how it's going to go. I'm going to try to keep people close.
It's also an incentive to show up to the podcast.
That's the real thing. Yeah. Yeah. Do your work every week. Yeah. 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 Well, you guys, thanks. This was really fun. Robert Chapman, man, thanks so much. It's great to meet you. And
yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, we'll catch you on whatever's next, 159.
Bye.
Bye.